This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.
Thirdly, notice that together with transformation, you have continuity, and this is the beautiful part of it. Jesus does not become another person. Remember how Paul says, we shall be changed after the manner of Christ. We shall be changed, but it is we who shall be changed. Despite the transformation, there is continuity. The risen one is recognized as the Jesus they had known before. And so Mary cries out in verse 16, Rabboni, which means teacher. That's John 20, 16. And in 21, 7, the disciples say, it is the Lord. And so there's a promise to claim here. When our resurrection bodies are made perfect in glory, we shall recognize one another. It is we who shall be changed. There's continuity. But this very passage raises a very interesting question. Both in the case of Mary and in the disciples, there is initially an inability to recognize Jesus. You have the same thing in Luke 24. Their eyes were closed, and they did not recognize him. Then their eyes are opened. For this next section, I'm very indebted to Peter Kraft and his book, Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Heaven But Never Dreamed of Asking. We come to the top of page 30, Roman numeral 2, Ways of Recognition. And we begin with hiddenness, out of which there is disclosure. First, there is hiddenness. Look first at John 20, verses 11 to 18, the encounter with Mary Magdalene. Verse 14 in particular. At this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realize that it was Jesus. How strange. Look also at chapter 21. John 21, verse 4. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. Now, you could take the view that he's too distant to be recognized, but there may be another factor at work. He's close enough to be heard, at least. You have the story of the Emmaus disciples to which I just referred, Luke 24, verses 13 to 35. And at the beginning of that story, we read, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. Now, out of that hiddenness, there comes revelation. We come to point B. Peter Kraft makes the point that the followers of Jesus, and in this case, his most intimate followers, did not recognize him by mere bodily appearance, but by what he said and did. In other words, disclosures of character bring recognition. Mere bodily appearance is not enough for recognizing the risen Christ. It's what he says and does. do you see already that there's a clue here to the way we will function in the afterlife? What age will we be in heaven? What about a child who dies in its mother's womb as compared to someone who dies at the age of 95? Do you see how this opens something up? Look at chapter 20, verse 16. Jesus said to her, Mary, it is his voice that brings understanding. And in chapter 21, how do the disciples recognize that the figure on the shore is Jesus? What does the record tell us? The miracle of the great number of fish, 153 fish. Peter would recall what happened in Luke chapter 5. So the utterance of the voice of the beloved and the miracle which recalls his mighty deeds before his resurrection. How did the Emmaus disciples recognize Jesus? By the restoration of table fellowship, as he broke the bread and gave thanks, their eyes were opened. Let me suggest that what's going on could be illustrated this way. The way of recognition, according to the resurrection narratives, is violently out of keeping with the way we identify people. This is the way we view and judge people. We judge what's in the soul by what's in the body. Conversely, the disciples recognize body by the revelation of what's in the soul. That would be a good subject for a devotional to a senior high group. I was acutely aware of this as my daughters were going through those turbulent teenage years, and the agony each morning about the bodily appearance, because that so determined the way other people viewed and evaluated them. I think of this on Academy Awards night. If the people attending the Oscars could be seen in light of the soul rather than the body, how the whole thing would change. I thought one night as my daughters were watching the Miss Mississippi pageant, one member of the group in our home being a future contestant in the Miss Louisiana pageant, and just the comments they were making, and I thought afterwards, what if the girls in that beauty pageant were being seen for what's in their soul rather than what's in their body? And I found myself wanting to take my daughters over to Calcutta for a week-long tour with Mother Teresa, and how if that same reversal could occur, what beauty would emerge? I'm pondering here how much to digress here. Peter Kraft makes the point that the face is the window of the soul. That's why the face is so crucial. Sometimes, think about this when you are in the presence of a person who is physically deformed or even hideous, and look at the face, and look more specifically at the eyes, and see how the eyes will reflect the refinement and the serenity of the soul. That's why it's often difficult for us to look one another in the eye, because the eye will betray things that are going on inside. I always think of this with my cockapoo, Dixie. How does a dog know to look you in the eye? That's always intrigued me. There's a certain kinship between even an animal and a human being, and the dog naturally looks you in the eye. You might be pointing to food on the floor and still into the eye. So in this light, consider the words of 1 John 3, verses 1 and 2, written by this same author. 1 John 3, verses 1 and 2. We know that when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And where will we be looking? Another document by this writer tells us, Revelation 22, verse 4. They will see his face. And if you get in the habit of, if you think in terms of the resurrected community viewing people this way, then you can understand why the age of the body becomes irrelevant. It's been said that in heaven we will have the innocence of youth, of childhood, the zest of youth, and the wisdom of age. We'll be all ages and no ages. This is the key, I think. Let's go now to these other two points. Soteriology, John chapter 20, and ecclesiology, John chapter 21. I'm saying that this is the way fallen humanity appraises other people. And what you have in the resurrection narratives is a glimpse into the way we shall relate in the resurrection body. You really need to read Lewis's The Great Divorce if you haven't. He talks about the resurrection body as luminescent and the soul shining through, so that the light of the resurrection body is owing to the light of the character that's been fashioned into the image of Christ. Am I addressing what you're asking, Dennis?
I just had it turned around.
Okay. I'm using the term soteriology and ecclesiology for the theology of these two chapters on the resurrection in John. And I'm indebted for this to Grant Osborne, who teaches at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and his doctoral dissertation, The Resurrection Narratives of the Gospels. First, the necessity of resurrection. Let's relate this to what we've been talking about ever since we started our study of the Gospel of John, the centrality of the cross. The cross is the place of coronation, the hour of Jesus' glorification. Let us now modify that a bit and say it is the beginning of his glorification. Because once glorified, he remains glorified. And the glory that shines forth from the cross flows through the door of the empty tomb. The necessity of resurrection is this, that unless Jesus rises from the dead, it is nonsense to talk about the cross as a place of glorification. It's really, as Paul argues in 1 Corinthians 15, if Christ is not risen from the dead, the preaching of the cross is a waste of time. Roy McLean, who was once pastor of the First Baptist Church in Atlanta, used to say that a dead Christ is no more saving than a sitting Buddha. The cross remains the center, but it can only remain the center because of the resurrection. If Christ remains under the power of death, talk about his glory is hollow. Yeah.
I'm sorry, when Paul emphasizes so much the preaching of the cross is all that he knows and all that he preaches, it seems here that he would have to make that point, he would have to preach the resurrection and several other things as a part of that now. Would you say that was true?
Well, the resurrection also stands at the heart of the Pauline gospel, and Richard Gaffin has shown that in his own doctoral dissertation. But As I hope to demonstrate next semester, the cross is at the very center. But the cross is only at the very center because Christ rose from the dead. And he says in 1 Corinthians 15, I declare unto you as of first importance that Christ died and that he was raised. So both are affirmed with equal vigor. But Paul, like Mark, is assaulting Christian triumphalism at every turn. And so you could say that you have a digest of it in Philippians 3, verse 10, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his suffering. He reverses the historical order. The power of the resurrection is essential for enduring the fellowship of his suffering. Well, more on that next semester. Point B, restoration of fellowship. John 1:14, somebody quote it for us, preferably in English. The Word became flesh, and what comes next? And dwelt among us, not, as an NIV first edition, lived for a while among us. That undermines the whole theology of John. The point is that once he takes up his dwelling, he stays. And after the three-day gap between death and resurrection, Jesus pointedly restores fellowship with his people. Just take your eyes off the text for a moment. How many appearances are there recorded in John 20 and 21? How many appearances of Jesus to his people? Oh, let me narrow it down a bit. If you exclude the appearance to Mary, how many other appearances are there? I shouldn't have held up my fingers. There are three. That's from preaching too many three-point sermons. Look, where do we start? Where's the first appearance? Point us to the verse 20, verse 19. On the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." There's the word of salvation in a nutshell. Where's the second? 26. Verse 26. A week later, his disciples were in the house again. Notice this glimpse into the fact that you have an extended number of appearances. Where's the third? 21, verse 1. Afterward, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Tiberias. Notice the significance of the sheer number. Three appearances before the circle of the 12 as a way of accentuating the restoration of fellowship. Notice that the Apostle John does not record the ascension. He does not deny it, but the absence of an ascension narrative underscores the fact that Jesus abides with his people through the Holy Spirit whom he gives. And that brings us to the next point, the gift of the Spirit. The extension of Jesus' ministry and the abiding of the restored fellowship entails the coming of the Spirit. Chapter 20, verses 21 to 23. And fourthly, the call to faith. Chapter 20, verses 21 to 23. And fourthly, and climactically, the call to faith. We talked about this when we surveyed John as a whole. Please observe the preparation for the statement of purpose in chapter 20, verses 30 and 31. the great climax, verse 28, Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." That is the confession for which the whole gospel has prepared. Then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." That takes us into John's readership that we will consider, Lord willing, tomorrow. And then the statement of purpose. The purpose is that you confess Jesus as the Christ, the Son of God. What do you link chapter 20, verse 28 with? We talked about this before. John 1, verses 1 to 18. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. Notice how all of these are interwoven here. My Lord and my God. The Word was God. And then in verse 31, the Son of God. The Word was with God. So here you see the artistry of the evangelist in bringing things to this magnificent conclusion. Now, chapter 21, we can gather under the heading Ecclesiology. Soteriology for chapter 20, ecclesiology for chapter 21. Three things to be noted here. First, apostolic authority. With respect to apostolic authority, the focus is upon the disciple whom Jesus loved. He's mentioned in verse 7, and then we come to verse 20. Peter turned and saw that the disciple whom Jesus loved was following them. The great emphasis here in chapter 21 is that the beloved disciple is a trustworthy witness. He is an eyewitness. And he is a trustworthy reporter of what he has seen. Look at chapter 21, verse 24. This is the disciple who testifies to these things and who wrote them down. We know that his testimony is true. Don't paint yourself into a corner where you have to come out with the view that John the Apostle wrote every word of the Gospel of John. If you do that, you're going to have trouble with verse 24. We know that his testimony is true. This gospel may have been published after the death of the beloved disciple, but it's just a matter of adding a footnote to his own record. Go back for a moment to the touch of verse 11. Simon Peter climbed aboard and dragged the net ashore. It was full of large fish, 153. Now, if you look at some of the commentators upon that verse, especially from the post-apostolic period, you will find all sorts of ingenious symbolism. I can recall sitting in a seminar in a hotel in Atlanta, Georgia, a seminar in which Raymond Brown participated shortly after writing his commentary on John, and he said, I expect that when I get to heaven and enter through the portals, Simon Peter's going to come up to me and say, "Look, there were 153 fish in the net." This is just the sort of detail that a former fisherman like John would record. No fisherman has difficulty with that number. That's just a little touch that you would expect from an eyewitness. Apostolic authority. We know that his testimony is true. There's the apostolic authority. Secondly, there's pastoral responsibility. And if the apostolic authority is accentuated in the case of the beloved disciple, pastoral responsibility, which is just another way of saying the same thing, is focused on Simon Peter. notice the list in verse 2. Simon Peter, Thomas called Didymus, etc. His name comes first for reasons that are fully explained in Matthew chapter 16. The main passage is John 21, verses 15 to 17, where after breakfast, Jesus takes Peter aside and engages in a private conversation. Let me suggest two comments on this passage. The first is that the threefold repetition recalls the threefold denial. Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? That seems deliberately chosen as a counterpart to the threefold denial. And secondly, that repetition underscores the importance of caring for the flock under the apostles' care. The importance of caring for the flock under the apostles' care. Please turn with me to 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5. I want to suggest to you that this passage is written in the vivid recollection of the conversation recorded in John 21. 1 Peter 5, verse 1. To the elders among you, I appeal as a fellow elder, a witness of Christ's sufferings, and one who will also share in the glory to be revealed. Be shepherds of God's flock that is under your care, serving as overseers, not because you must, but because you're willing, as God wants you to be. Not greedy for money, but eager to serve. Not lording it over those entrusted to you. What's the great incentive for Peter? Not lording it over those entrusted to you. That he was a broken man after the denial. Verse 4, and when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that will never fade away. Verse 5, God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. Where sin abounds, grace superabounds. In the providence of God, the very denial of Peter was a vital ingredient in his preparation for ministry. Just one word. You'll have to consider this on your own, and it's possible. Exegesis makes you have to be vulnerable to do exegesis, and it may well be that one of your favorite sermons would need to be reexamined. There are two verbs used in the Gospel of John for love, phileo and agapao. Both are used in this conversation between Jesus and Peter. And many a sermon has been based upon what is thought to be a sharp distinction between the two. Peter, do you agapao me? Yes, Lord, you know that I phileo you. Let me at least suggest for your consideration that this may be a case of a synonymous use of two different verbs. The Gospel of John, at least in many other respects, will use two words interchangeably in order to enrich the style. I ask you at least to look at Leon Morris's commentary on the passage, and for a further development, an essay in his book, Studies in the Fourth Gospel, on the fourth evangelist's use of synonyms. Just take that into consideration, even if it confirms you in your other view. Now, thirdly, identification with Jesus. we draw our attention now to verses 18 and 19. And brothers and sisters, take note. This is the climax of the conversation with Peter. Verse 18, I tell you the truth. When you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. Old age is a reversion to childhood. Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, follow me. There are volumes in those two verses. He said this about the death, and then he said, follow me. What do you conclude from that? After the resurrection, the only way to follow Jesus is in death. Luke 9:23, take up your cross daily and follow me. I did my master's thesis on the subject of following Jesus in the New Testament, and one thing that grabbed me in that was that once you get past the ascension, once the incarnate body of Jesus has been restored to heaven, the only context in which the people of God are said to follow Jesus is in the context of suffering and martyrdom. You don't follow Jesus around literally anymore, up and down Galilee. The only place to follow him is precisely in the context of death. I want you to turn with me back to 1 Peter, this time chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2. Again, the apostle recalls Jesus' last words to him, or close to them. 1 Peter 2:19. It is commendable if a man bears up under the pain of unjust suffering because he's conscious of God. Verse 21. To this you were called because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example. Notice the language. That you should follow in his steps. An echo, I suggest, of John 21, verse 19. And then he goes on to talk about the atoning death of Christ. Before we conclude this last point, turn to what Jesus says about the beloved disciple. Verse 22. If I want him, that is, the beloved disciple, to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me. Because of this, the rumor spread among the brothers that this disciple would not die. But Jesus did not say that he would not die. He only said, if I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? What do you conclude from that?
You don't tell anyone anybody's story but their own.
That's one very important lesson. That's one I like to suppress. What do you conclude from this labored explanation in verse 23? That John has, in fact, died, and probably by martyrdom. There's corroborative evidence for that. In other words, it was not a broken promise of Jesus. This is what I want you to get, and if you'll listen attentively, I'll let you get first in the lunch line. We're talking about ecclesiology. We're talking about church leadership. At the very heart of John's ecclesiology is identification with Jesus in his suffering. At the very heart of John's ecclesiology is identification with Jesus in his suffering. I urge you to beware of a Christian triumphalism in your very theory of ministry. There are all sorts of lures into that. And it can manifest itself as an aspiration to the biggest and the most prestigious church or the biggest and the most prestigious seminary. At the heart of ecclesiology lies taking up the cross and living under the banner of Christ crucified. And as Elizabeth Elliot says in her book, These Strange Ashes, identification with Christ in his crucifixion always means loss. And so the mentality of ministry that always wants gain is going to quench the power of the Spirit, because God's strength is made perfect in weakness. That is why, among other reasons, the cross is absolutely central in the gospel according to John. We have now surveyed the gospel of John, and I want on this last period devoted to this gospel to consider with you the pastoral purposes of this gospel. This is one of the most beneficial and potentially exciting approaches to a New Testament document. What did the writer of this gospel want to say to his original readers? And if we attend to this, I believe that we shall have a better grasp of how this gospel can be preached to our own contemporaries. So consider first John and his readers. First, a primary and a secondary audience. I call your attention back to the little picture on page 1 of the outline of the Gospel of John. I want to suggest to you that John is addressing both a believing and a non-believing audience. His primary audience is a circle of Christians under his care. And the secondary audience, which he wants to address through the primary audience, is the non-believing world beyond, consisting both of Jews and of Gentiles. I direct your attention to the statement of purpose in John 20, verse 31. We are fortunate in that this evangelist has given us an explicit statement of purpose. John 20, verse 31. These are written that you may believe. And there's a judgment call concerning the original verb in this clause. And that difference is reflected in the NIV text and margin. These are written that you may believe, or in the margin, that you may continue to believe. It's very hard to decide between those two readings. I want to suggest that if you go with the NIV text, that you may believe, that easily embraces both Christians and non-Christians. If you go with the NIV margin, then the accent is upon Christians continuing to or deepening in their belief. That's a matter that you will have to pursue on your own. But at any rate, let me take this position that the primary audience is the church and the secondary audience is the non-Christian world, through whom, who will come to Jesus through the witness of the primary audience. And then secondly, John is addressing a second generation of believers. I'm adopting the traditional view that the Gospel of John was written about 90 A.D. to a Christian community centered in Ephesus. You can read all about this in Guthrie's introduction. The traditional view, written about 90 A.D., to a community of Christians living in Ephesus in the province of Asia. And one basis for this judgment is found in Irenaeus, who quotes Polycarp, who was a follower of John the Apostle. And Irenaeus says, "John the disciple of the Lord, who leaned on his breast, himself issued the gospel while dwelling in Ephesus." There are various estimates about the validity of that judgment. Again, see Guthrie for a development. If this gospel was written about 90 A.D., we're 60 years past the date of the crucifixion, give or take a year. The chronology that we looked at earlier placed the crucifixion in A.D. 30. Here we are, A.D. 90, 60 years later. Thirdly, John's pastoral purposes. This is our focus. How does the Apostle John seek to minister to the little flock under his care 60 years after the events he records? Brothers and sisters, get in the habit of being evangelical redaction critics. Don't abhor the expression redaction criticism. It need not be an ugly expression. The question is, how do the needs of the Christian community under John's care determine his selection and his presentation of material from the life of Jesus? Don't shrink from a question like that. We're not suggesting John creates his theology, but the needs of his community will determine his selection and his presentation. Does not the Gospel of John itself show that he selected? Look at John 20, verse 30. "Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book." He's selective. And the concluding verse of the whole gospel, "Jesus did many other things." If every one of them were written down, the whole world wouldn't have room to contain them. So what I want to suggest to you today is, I think, potentially a very exciting approach to the Gospel of John. Let's go to Roman numeral 2 then. The problem of distance. Imagine yourself as a Christian living 60 years after the crucifixion and resurrection. How does John address the problem of distance? First, the blessing of Jesus. Listen to John 17, verse 20. In the high priestly prayer, "I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message." That would be consoling, would it not, that Jesus had prayed for you, even though you were not present at the time. Or John 20, verse 29, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Secondly, the gift of the Spirit. Jesus has ascended, but he abides with his people beyond the first generation through the Paraclete. Listen to John 14 and verse 16, and listen as though through the eyes of a second generation Christian. "I will ask the Father, and he will give you another counselor to be with you forever." As a matter of fact, the imparted Spirit unleashes blessing into the Christian community that surpassed those that the first generation could experience. Look back at 14, verse 12. "I tell you the truth, anyone who has faith in me will do what I have been doing. He will do even greater things than these because I'm going to the Father." That addresses the problem of distance. And then thirdly, the apostolic witness. The crucial link between the time of Jesus and the Christian community in Ephesus is the Apostle John. His witness is the crucial bridge, historically speaking. And so in that light, notice the cruciality of 19 verse 35. The man who saw it has given testimony. He testifies so that you also may believe. That's John 19 verse 35. Also, 21 verse 24. This is the disciple who wrote them down. We know that his testimony is true.
This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.